Pain is a function of nerves, Idaho reminded himself. Pain comes as light comes to the eyes. Effort comes from the muscles, not from nerves. It was an old Mentat drill, and he completed it in the space of one breath, flexed his right wrist, and severed an artery against the sugar wire. Titanic leaped to the chair, hit its triplock to release the bindings, shouted for medical aid. It was revealing that assistants came swarming at once through doors hidden in wall panels.
There was always a bit of foolishness in Duncan, Jessica thought.
Faradin studied Jessica a moment while the medics ministered to Idaho.
I didn't say I was going to accept his alia. That's not why he cut his wrist, Jessica said.
Oh? I thought he was simply removing himself.
You're not that stupid, Jessica said. Stop pretending with me.
He smiled.
I'm well aware that alia would destroy me. Not even the Bene Gesserit could expect me to accept her.
Jessica bent a weighted stare upon Faradin. What was this young scion of House Carino? He didn't play the fool well. Again, she recalled Leto's words that she'd encounter an interesting student. And the preacher wanted this as well, Idaho said. She wished she'd met this preacher.
Will you banish Wencicia?
Jessica asked.
It seems a reasonable bargain,
Faradin said. Jessica glanced at Idaho. The medics had finished with him. Less dangerous restraints held him in the floater chair.
Mentats should beware of absolutes, she said.
I'm tired, Idaho said. You've no idea how tired I am.
When it's overexploited, even loyalty wears out finally, Faradin said. Again, Jessica shot that measuring stare at him. Faradin, seeing this, thought,
In time she'll know me for certain, and that could be valuable. A renegade Bene Gesserit of my own. It's the one thing her son had that I don't have. Let her get only a glimpse of me now. She can see the rest later.
A fair exchange, Faradin said. I accept your offer on your terms. He signaled the mute against the wall with a complex flickering of fingers. The mute nodded. Faradin bent to the chair's controls, released Jessica. Titanic asked,
My lord, are you sure?
Isn't it what we discussed? Faradin asked.
Yes, but...
Faradin chuckled, addressed Jessica.
Tyke suspects my sources, but one learns from books and reels only that certain things can be done. Actual learning requires that you do those things.
Jessica mused on this as she lifted herself from the chair. Her mind returned to Faradin's hand signals. He had an Atreides-style battle language. It spoke of careful analysis. Someone here was consciously copying the Atreides.
Of course, Jessica said. You'll want me to teach you as the Bene Gesserit are taught.
Faradin beamed at her.
The one offer I cannot resist, he said.
The password was given to me by a man who died in the dungeons of Arrakeen. You see, that is where I got this ring in the shape of a tortoise. It was in the sook outside the city where I was hidden by the rebels. The password? Oh, that has been changed many times since then. It was persistence, and the countersign was tortoise. It got me out of there alive. That's why I bought this ring. A reminder.
Tagir Mohandis, Conversations with a Friend. Leto was far out on the sand when he heard the worm behind him, coming to his thumper there and the dusting of spice he'd spread around the dead tigers. There was a good omen for this beginning of their plan. Worms were scarce enough in these parts most times. The worm was not essential, but it helped. There would be no need for Ganima to explain a missing body. By this time he knew that Ganima had worked herself into the belief that he was dead. Only a tiny, isolated capsule of awareness would remain to her, a walled-off memory which could be recalled by words uttered in the ancient language shared only by the two of them in all of this universe. Seisher Nibui. If she heard those words, Golden Path, only then would she remember him. Until then, he was dead. Now Leto felt truly alone. He moved with the random walk which made only those sounds natural to the desert. Nothing in his passage would tell that worm back there that human flesh moved here. It was a way of walking so deeply conditioned in him that he didn't need to think about it. The feet moved of themselves, no measurable rhythm to their pacing. Any sound his feet made could be ascribed to the wind, to gravity. No human passed here. When the worm had done its work behind him, Leto crouched behind a dune slip face and peered back toward the attendant. Yes, he was far enough. He planted a thumper and summoned his transportation. The worm came swiftly, giving him barely enough time to position himself before it engulfed the thumper. As it passed, he went up its side on the maker hooks, opened the sensitive leading edge of a ring, and turned the mindless beast southeastward. It was a small worm, but strong. He could sense the strength in its twisting as it hissed across the dunes. There was a following breeze, and he felt the heat of their passage, the friction which the worm converted to the beginnings of spice within itself. As the worm moved, his mind moved. Stilgar had taken him up for his first worm journey. Leto had only to let his memory flow, and he could hear Stilgar's voice, calm and precise, full of politeness from another age. Not for Stilgar the threatening staggers of a Fremen drunk on spice liquor. Not for Stilgar the loud voice and bluster of these times. No, Stilgar had his duties. He was an instructor of royalty.
In the olden times, the birds were named for their songs. Each wind had its name. A 6-click wind was called Apostaza, a 20-click wind was Kueshma, and a 100-click wind was Heianali, Heianali the man-pusher. Then there was the wind of the demon in the open desert, Hula Sikali Wala, the wind that eats flesh.
And Leto, who had already known these things, had nodded his gratitude at the wisdom of such instruction. But Stilgar's voice could be filled with many valuable things.
There were in olden times certain tribes which were known to be water hunters. They were called Idwali, which meant water insects, because those people wouldn't hesitate to steal the water of another Fremen. If they caught you alone in the desert, they would not even leave you the water of your flesh. There was this place where they lived, Sich Jakurutu. That's where the other tribes banded and wiped out the Idwali. That was a long time ago, before Kynes even, in my great-great-grandfather's days. And from that day to this, no Fremen has gone to Jakurutu. It is taboo.
Thus had Leto been reminded of knowledge which lay in his memory. It had been an important lesson about the working of memory. A memory was not enough, even for one whose past was as multiform as his, unless its use was known and its value revealed to judgment. Jakurutu would have water, a wind trap, all of the attributes of a Fremen siege, plus the value without compare that no Fremen would venture there. Many of the young would not even know such a place as Jakurutu had ever existed. Oh, they would know about Fondak, of course, but that was a smuggler place. It was a perfect place for the dead to hide, among the smugglers and the dead of another age.
Thank you, Stilgar.
The worm tired before dawn. Leto slid off its side and watched it dig itself into the dunes, moving slowly in the familiar pattern of the creatures. It would go deep and sulk.
I must wait out the day, he thought.
He stood atop a dune and scanned all around. Emptiness, emptiness, emptiness. Only the wavering track of the vanished worm broke the pattern. The slow cry of a nightbird challenged the first green line of light along the eastern horizon. Leto dug himself into the sand's concealment, inflated a still tent around his body, and sent the tip of a sand snorkel questing for air. For a long time before sleep came, he lay in the enforced darkness thinking about the decision he and Ganima had made. It had not been an easy decision, especially for Ganima. He had not told her all of his vision, nor all of the reasoning derived from it. It was a vision, not a dream, in his thinking now. But the peculiarity of this thing was that he saw it as a vision of a vision. If any argument existed to convince him that his father still lived, it lay in that vision. The life of the prophet locks us into his vision, Leto thought. And a prophet could only break out of the vision by creating his death at variance with that vision. That was how it appeared in Leto's doubled vision, and he pondered this as it related to the choice he had made. Poor Baptist John, he thought. If he'd only had the courage to die some other way. But perhaps his choice had been the bravest one. How do I know what alternatives faced him? I know what alternatives faced my father, though. Leto sighed. To turn his back on his father was like betraying a god. But the Atreides Empire needed shaking up. It had fallen into the worst of Paul's vision. How casually it obliterated men. It was done without a second thought. The mainspring of a religious insanity had been wound tight and left ticking. And we're locked in my father's vision. A way out of that insanity lay along the golden path, Leto knew. His father had seen it. But humanity might come out of that golden path and look back down it at Muad'Dib's time, seeing that as a better age. Humankind had to experience the alternative to Muad'Dib, though, or never understand its own myths. Security, peace, prosperity. Given the choice, there was little doubt what most citizens of this empire would select. Though they hate me, he thought, though Ghani hate me. His right hand itched, and he thought of the terrible glove in his vision. It will be, he thought. Yes, it will be. Arrakis, give me strength, he prayed. His planet remained strong and alive beneath him and around him. its sand pressed close against the still tent. Dune was a giant counting its massed riches. It was a beguiling entity, both beautiful and grossly ugly. The only coin its merchants really knew was the blood pulse of their own power, no matter how that power had been amassed. They possessed this planet the way a man might possess a captive mistress, or the way the Bene Gesserits possessed their sisters. No wonder Stilgar hated the merchant priests.
Thank you, Stilgar.
Leto recalled then the beauties of the old siege ways, the life lived before the coming of the Imperium's technocracy, and his mind flowed as he knew Stilgar's dreams flowed. Before the glow globes and lasers, before the ornithopters and spice crawlers, there had been another kind of life. Brown-skinned mothers with babies on their hips, lamps which burned spice oil amidst a heavy fragrance of cinnamon, naives who persuaded their people while knowing none could be compelled. It had been a dark swarming of life in rocky burrows.
A terrible glove will restore the balance, Leto thought.
Presently, he slept.
I saw his blood and a piece of his robe which had been ripped by sharp claws. His sister reports vividly of the tigers, the shortness of their attack. We have questioned one of the plotters, and others are dead or in custody. Everything points to a Corino plot. A truthsayer has attested to this testimony.
Stilgar's report to the Landsrod Commission. Ferodin studied Duncan Idaho through the spy circuit, seeking a clue to that strange man's behavior. It was shortly afternoon, and Idaho waited outside the quarters assigned to the Lady Jessica, seeking audience with her. Would she see him? She'd know they were spied upon, of course. But would she see him? Around Ferodin lay the room where Titanic had guided the training of the Lhasa Tigers, an illegal room, really, filled as it was with forbidden instruments from the hands of the Tlaelaxu and Ixians. By the movement of switches at his right hand, Ferodin could look at Idaho from six different angles, or shift to the interior of the Lady Jessica's suite where the spying facilities were equally sophisticated. Idaho's eyes bothered Ferodin. Those pitted metal orbs which the Tlaelaxu had given their Gola in the regrowth tanks marked their possessor as profoundly different from other humans. Ferodin touched his own eyelids, feeling the hard surfaces of the permanent contact lenses which conceal the total blue of his spice addiction. Idaho's eyes must record a different universe. How could it be otherwise? It almost tempted Ferodin to seek out the Tlaelaxu surgeons and answer that question himself.
Why did Idaho try to kill himself? Was that really what he tried? He must have known we wouldn't permit it.
Idaho remained a dangerous question mark. Titanic wanted to keep him on Seleucia or kill him. Perhaps that would be best. Ferodin shifted to a frontal view. Idaho sat on a hard bench outside the door to the Lady Jessica's suite. It was a windowless foyer with light wood walls, decorated by lance pennants. Idaho had been on that bench more than an hour, and appeared ready to wait there forever. Ferodin bent close to the screen. The loyal swordmaster of the Atreides, instructor of Paul Nuadib, had been treated kindly by his years on Arrakis. He'd arrived with a youthful spring in his step. A steady spice diet must have helped him, of course. And that marvelous metabolic balance which the Tlaelaxu tanks always imparted. Did Idaho really remember his past before the tanks? No other whom the Tlaelaxu had revived could claim this. What an enigma this Idaho was! The reports of his death were in the library. The Sardaukar who'd slain him reported his prowess. 19 of their number dispatched by Idaho before he'd fallen. 19 Sardaukar! His flesh had been well worth sending to the regrowth tanks. But the Tlaelaxu had made a mentat out of him. What a strange creature lived in that regrown flesh! How did it feel to be a human computer in addition to all of his other talents?
Why did he try to kill himself?
Ferodin knew his own talents and held few illusions about them. He was a historian, archaeologist, and judge of men. Necessity had forced him to become an expert on those who would serve him. Necessity and a careful study of the Atreides. He saw it as the price always demanded of aristocracy. To rule required accurate and incisive judgments about those who wielded your power. More than one ruler had fallen through mistakes and excesses of his underlings. Careful study of the Atreides revealed a superb talent in choosing servants. They'd known how to maintain loyalty, how to keep a fine edge on the ardor of their warriors. Idaho was not acting in character. Why?